At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
You know what would be really good right now? A drone that could deliver beer, that's what. Before that, though, we got to do the economic news from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kyle Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 22nd of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I'm going to let the Federal Reserve do the heavy lifting in setting up what has turned out to be the theme of the program today. We got the minutes of the Fed's latest meeting this morning, and the word trade is mentioned 21 times, including in this passage. Quote, some participants suggested that in the event of a major escalation in trade disputes, the complex nature of trade issues, including the entire range of their effects on output and inflation, presented a challenge in determining the appropriate monetary policy response. In other words, if the trade war really gets going, the Fed's basically going to wind up doing one of those shrug things, trying to figure out interest rates. And just because I know you want to know, in their prior meeting, trade was mentioned just 7 times. All right, now to actual trade policy. Relatively low-level talks between U.S. and Chinese negotiators are happening this week in Washington, even as both sides are putting more tariffs in place this week. And while the president has said he's not holding out a lot of hope these talks get anywhere, if you're going to fix a problem, you got to start somewhere, right? So if the option is more and more and more tariffs, where is square one? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
Now is the time for negotiators to get specific with their wish lists. In other words, don't just ask for clothes for your birthday. Ask for the shirt you want in the size and color you want.
Unfortunately, this whole China trade war has been discussed with such a broad brush.
Mary Lovely at Syracuse University.
It's already led the public to expect that we're going to get something out of China that has to do with them buying more of our goods or us restricting their imports.
She says that's exactly what the U.S. shouldn't be seeking. Instead, negotiators should stick to really specific policy changes that will address the reason for these tariffs in the first place. U.S. allegations that China treats U.S. firms unfairly with respect to their technology and intellectual property. China's making a big push to develop its own high-tech sector. So Mark Bush at Georgetown says a creative ask on the U.S. side might be something like
some assurance that China will not block the fruits of any state-sponsored R&D from benefiting U.S. producers. So in a way, the irony is we're asking for us to benefit from their massive outlay on R&D.
But for Christine McDaniel at George Mason's Mercatus Center, the more promising trade meetings this week are actually with Japan and the EU, not China.
Just us asking China to do something has very limited effects. We need more allies to really make this work.
She says when it comes to pressuring China to make big structural changes, we can't go it alone. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
You know who's not worried about tariffs? Target. That's who. Shares in Target opened at an all-time high this morning after the retailer reported quarterly profits, revenue, and sales that beat anything the company has seen in years. CEO Brian Cornell told CNBC he's got a lot of levers to pull. That's a quote to make sure we're still price competitive, tariffs-wise. So from WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris explains what that might mean.
Target, like its competitor Walmart, is on a roll as shoppers keep shopping. But that may not last if the Trump administration's tariffs push prices higher. Neil Sanders, an analyst with Global Data Retail, says Target is likely thinking about
where they can extract further cost from that business to offset perhaps the increase in cost from tariffs.
One way the retailer could do that is by stocking up. Laura Dawson studies trade issues at the Washington think tank, the Wilson Center. She says when the first wave of tariffs hit, Target and other companies knew their supplies would be disrupted, so they started buying.
I know what products are price or location sensitive, and so I'm going to build up my inventories there. So I imagine Target warehouses are looking pretty full.
Another way the retailer could push back against the impact of tariffs is by switching suppliers. Michael Zuccaro, apparel analyst at Moody's, says some companies are already doing that.
That serves a lower cost. It also helps serve to move production closer to the U.S. market so it can reduce lead times.
But that might have a limited impact, according to Jonathan Doe, business professor at Villanova University. For lots of what Target sells, there's only one supplier. And
as we, for example, change importing country source from, say, China to Southeast Asia or to Latin America, there'll be different tariffs, different customs brokers, freight forwarders, shippers, etc.
In other words, supply chains are complicated. And if the tariff war goes on, rising prices might catch up with American shoppers and chip away at Target's bottom line. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
We're going to do a net neutrality story. Now, remember, that's the idea repealed by the Federal Communications Commission earlier this year that internet service providers have to treat all content equally. No slowing down, no higher prices, no nothing. Those ISPs are now free to do what they like with content on their networks. And Verizon did. The Los Angeles Times reports this morning that while the huge Mendocino complex fire up in Northern California was at its worst, Verizon told the Santa Clara County Fire Department it would have to upgrade its data package if it wanted unrestricted service. The company now says throttling data speeds while the fire was burning was a customer service mistake. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
A lot of the talk about the dangers of repealing net neutrality have focused on things like whether service providers like AT&T would give preferential speeds to HBO and other content it owns. Public safety, not a big part of the discussion. Gigi Sohn researches technology law and policy at Georgetown. She says this incident,
why it's relevant is it demonstrates that ISPs like Verizon will act in their economic interests even at the expense of public safety.
Anytime there's mention of data throttling, it brings up the idea of net neutrality and its recent repeal. But Verizon, which did not give an interview for this story, says net neutrality wasn't the issue here. They may have a point.
It's not clear to me that there are implications of this case for net neutrality.
Blair Levin is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. He says Verizon pushing for more money during a fire would have been legal, even with net neutrality in place.
The actions that Verizon took, though they certainly violate good customer service, do not strike me as being illegal under that contract.
But the wildfire incident is already cited in an appeal of the FCC's decision to get rid of net neutrality. Tuna Amobi is an analyst at CFRA Research.
I think you're likely to see more and more calls from the proponents of net neutrality to perhaps use this as some leverage to, you know, maybe rekindle the debate.
On the agenda, oversight. Without net neutrality in place, there's no real authority making sure internet service providers aren't jeopardizing public safety. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
To the list of things the stock market does not care about here in the late summer of 2018, you can now add the guilty plea of President Trump's one-time lawyer and the conviction of his former campaign chairman, the S&P 500 bull market winning streak. And you can quibble about how it's measured, but by most conventional measures, that bull market now sits at a record 3,453 days. Today, though, split decision. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A year ago this week, Harvey, by then no longer a hurricane, dumped 9 trillion gallons of water on southeast Texas. Parts of greater Houston were underwater for days. The storm killed more than 100 people in all. Total damage topped $125 billion. A lot of that destruction being people's homes. Marketplace's Andy Euler went to Houston to see how people are getting on a year later.
Meyerland is a neighborhood in southwest Houston with a mix of ranch-style homes built in the 1950s and 60s and brand-new modern spreads. There's also a ton of for-sale signs in yards, lots of them for sale by owner with just a phone number.
Thank you for calling about 5025 Jason Street. The asking price is $395,000. The house only received between 18 to 24 inches of water during Harvey. That was the only time the house ever flooded.
The owner-seller here is stressing that Harvey was the only time this house flooded because so many homes in Meyerland have flooded 2, 3, 4 times. Some folks are just tired of the stress and cost of living in a floodplain.
I don't buy a house here because I don't think it's worth it.
Simone Burko lives just down the road from the phone seller. She and her husband, David, have their own for sale sign in the yard. They bought their house in 2005, and David remembers a few smaller floods, but he says Hurricane Harvey was a game changer.
We were here without any way to get out. We were together about 12 hours in the water, and I don't have to tell you what kind of water it was.
It was sewage-laden water, waist deep throughout their house. The Coast Guard rescued them in a raft, and they spent the week living with their in-laws in Austin, waiting for the floodwaters to recede. With no mortgage on their house, they weren't legally required to have flood insurance, and they didn't buy it. Any renovation expenses would be on their dollar. David says he and Simone don't want to live here anymore. They're retired, on a fixed income, and don't want to fret about future floods.
If you want to buy a house, you, and you go to this neighborhood, which is considered a very good neighborhood, very good, you won't buy a house if it's not either raised or new.
In fact, raising foundations for new houses above the old level is a requirement in Houston's new building code that goes into effect September 1st, at least in neighborhoods like Meyerland or other parts considered to be in the 100-year floodplain. David Burko got a quote of more than $200,000 to lift up his house. Too much for him, but not for the builders and developers who have bought up thousands of lots around here. Everyone from billion-dollar hedge funds to mom-and-pop investors. Horacio Santos works with a group of financial partners, acquiring homes that are down to the studs in concrete. He knows many sellers are tired of dealing with FEMA, with insurance companies, the city, and the county.
It is a business. So we are going to kind of take advantage of that, but we try to be fair about it. You know, there are people out there that are lowballing big time.
Santos says investors are making big money as they buy up flooded houses on the cheap and flip them. But the wider community can often lose out. The guy in charge of the county's buyback program is James Wade.
When investors come into those areas and either turn them into rentals or flip them for profit, you have new owners who may or may not be aware of the flooding history and the problems there.
Texas law doesn't require landlords to tell tenants their homes have flooded or sit in a floodplain. Marvin Odom, a former CEO of Shell Oil, has been the chief recovery officer for Houston since Harvey. He says it's not the place of government to dictate to the market what can and cannot happen.
This is where the market actually has to work, get the neighborhood rebuilt, and the neighborhood will actually find its way through that.
Back in the Meyerland neighborhood, people walk their dogs and wave to construction workers, clearing away house debris and readying the land for new foundations. Foundations that will be 5 to 10 feet higher than before. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The Alaskan seafood industry is going to be watching those negotiations Tracy was telling us about real closely. China is Alaska's biggest seafood market, and fish writ large are on Beijing's list of tariffs on American imports that are set to kick in September. But even without a trade war, fishing in Alaska of late hasn't been all that great, which is by way of prelude for the latest installment of our series, My Economy, how people are actually getting by away from the economic headlines. Here you go.
My name is Hannah Heimbuck. I'm a commercial fisherman from Homer, Alaska. My brother and I are drift gill netters. We fish for sockeye salmon. We grew up deckhanding with our dad on his boats in a couple different areas in Alaska. And 2 years ago, we decided to invest in our own operation. You know, we're in our early 30s and kind of looked at each other and we're like, well, I guess we're in this together. Probably our biggest annual investment is our boat payment. That runs about $11,000. We also have permit payments. That's another, $5,000. And then after that, you have the basic maintenance. You know, we spent a few thousand dollars upgrading. So we have a boat that's in tip-top shape, but we needed to make more than $20,000 to break even this year. We did not come close to that. We're looking at a record downturn for our fishery, and I think we put in less than 5,000 pounds of sockeye this year, which is, you know, definitely a disaster season. We will be making our boat payment not from the boat business, but from our other work. You know, for instance, my brother is doing winter squid fishing in California. He did that last year, and he'll probably do that again this year. The rest of the year, I work in fisheries policy. If I'm not able to catch fish, I go talk about it. You know, running my own business, especially one that gets me out in a wild landscape, you know, I think that really satisfies that need to be independent and self-reliant. Probably the best way to put it is, you know, sometimes it's not always fun. Sometimes you're physically miserable or worried, but I really like who I am when I'm fishing.
We don't have any of these stories to tell unless you tell them to us. Drop us a line. Let us know how your economy is doing, would you? There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up,
we're looking for solutions, not just for penalty tariffs.
The trade war that keeps on a giving. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 88 points this Wednesday, 0.3%, 25,733. The NASDAQ, 29 points to the good, 0.3%, 78.89. The S&P 500 declined a point, 28.61. The S&P 500 bull market run. This is the last time I'm going to say this, actually, for a while. 3,453 days. Erica Barris told you about Target's really, really good earnings report. Strongest sales growth in 13 years and all that. Investors were, yes, they were happy. The Minneapolis-based retailer surged almost 3.2% today. Lowe's is doing a little remodeling to better compete with Home Depot. It's shutting its Orchard Supply stores, which is going to wreck my weekends, by the way, and fixing to slim down inventory at Lowe's. Lowe's picked up 5.8%. Seriously, that's my go-to hardware store. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.82%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There were more hearings today by the U.S. Trade Representative on the next batch of Chinese tariffs the White House wants to put into place. Section 301 is the vernacular. $200 billion worth is the amount. Julie Hughes is up tomorrow. She's the president of the U.S. Fashion Industry Association, clothes, accessories, all of that. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
My guess is that those tariffs, should they be imposed, will show up on consumers of clothing more quickly than they will on anything else. What's your sense of that?
I totally agree with you. And, you know, the initial tariffs, companies pay that duty first. But when you start getting to consumer products, like what's on the list that we're talking about tomorrow, apparel products, handbags, backpacks, everything that families are buying right now for back to school, you're going to see those price rises a little bit faster if the administration follows through on this threat to impose 10% or 25% tariffs on the imports.
How dependent is the American fashion industry on China? I mean, couldn't you just go somewhere else and get this stuff?
Yeah, that's a great question. And obviously, companies aren't dependent on just one country for everything, but what's happened in the textile and apparel industry, there's a lot of products that are only made in China and that are predominantly made in China. Almost every company has some business that's in China today because China is the global center for textile and apparel production, not just to the U.S. market.
So there's a case to be made, and the administration has made it, right? And it's legitimate that there has been intellectual property theft and there has been forced technology transfer. I wonder, though, whether you believe you will be heard by the USTR when you bring a message that is not related to those things, but is related to direct consumer items and the tariffs and the effect those will have.
You know, the fact is, tariffs aren't a great solution because American consumers and American companies pay the tariffs. The Chinese don't. There's other ways to do it. And really, we look at the more global approach. The ideal would be let's use the World Trade Organization and let's use the close relationships that we have with our allies in the EU and Canada and other countries to work with China and find specific criteria, specific accomplishments to end some of these practices.
Yeah, fair enough. Last question, and then I'll let you go. I'm sure you saw the other day that the president told Reuters, you know, he's got no timeline for ending this thing, and he doesn't have high hopes for these Chinese negotiations that are happening in Washington this week. What happens if this doesn't go away?
I'd like to be optimistic, and I think that there's a path forward.
Okay.
And what I'd like to hope we see, which is a pause put on the implementation of these retaliatory tariffs until there's a chance to have serious negotiations. Can we have a summit? Can we have a Xi Jinping, Donald Trump summit in November when there are two opportunities for the leaders to meet? We're looking for solutions, not just for penalty tariffs.
Julia Hughes, she's the president of the U.S. Fashion Industry Association, testifying tomorrow in front of the USTR on these 301 hearings. Ma'am, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Chinese negotiators are here, Washington really, as Tracy was telling us. The Chinese economy, meanwhile, is still mostly happening back home, where, as Marketplace's China correspondent Jennifer Pak tells us, suppliers and manufacturers aren't really all that worried.
So far, some 2,000 items are subject to tariffs, either in the U.S. or China. You might think Chinese companies affected by these would be scrambling to find ways to manage risks and maintain their profit margins. Instead, a lot of businesses tell us,
we do not think this is a big problem. The trade dispute will be resolved soon. We're confident about this.
That's Juliet Young, whose firm buys raw pecans from the U.S. and sells them on to Chinese distributors. She spoke to us back in May, just after China imposed retaliatory tariffs on U.S. food exports, including an extra duty on American pecans of 15%. Now, China has raised the tariff to 40%. China's media has downplayed the impact on Chinese businesses.
President Donald Trump has started a trade war against China.
An animation video of a bikini-clad Californian almond on state-backed channel CGTN. It's a lighthearted appeal to American viewers. The U.S. must stop its trade dispute, or China will continue to retaliate. The message is, in a tariff war, the U.S. will hurt more. By the time Shanghai's Consumer Electronics Show took place in mid-June, a second round of tariffs and counter-tariffs seemed likely. A small plastic robot performed a lively dance on an exhibition stage. The routine and music were upbeat, just like Claudia Zhou. She handles overseas sales of the Handy Blocks toy robot that teaches kids coding. She says her product was initially on the U.S. tariff list, but she's happy it was later dropped.
Trump is a very cunning president. I believe that he values access to the Chinese market, and he won't keep Chinese sellers out of the American market either.
A major rail station in Wuxi City, a short bullet train ride from Shanghai. About 10 minutes from the terminal is the Wuxi Xingyun Universal Machinery Company. The pile drivers it exports for construction projects all across America have just been subjected to a 25% U.S. tariff. But, says boss Wang Yao, most of his Chinese competitors think his firm is lucky.
Our U.S. partner has decided to pass the extra cost to customers by raising its own sales price by 25%.
Still, he's thinking of ways to reduce costs for his U.S. client. Wang Yao shows me the steel frames needed to support his pile drivers. The frames, too, are subject to U.S. tariffs, so he's now planning to manufacture these in America and avoid the duties. Wang Yao says he's preparing for a drawn-out trade dispute between the U.S. and China.
Even if the two sides reach a consensus, I think the trade relationship will follow the trend of protectionism.
But he says few of his industry colleagues share his concern. In Wuxi City, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I think is a tell that the gang at IBM has too much time on its hands, but they are using that time awesomely. The company got a new patent this month, one on a very long list, yes, for a 107-year-old company, but this one might be the best. Dated August the 7th, the title of this thing is Drone Delivery of Coffee Based on a Cognitive State of Mind of an Individual. So, you know where this is going, but I'm just going to read you part of the abstract. Here it is. Quote, the drink is connected to the UAV, that's the drone, and the UAV flies to an area including people and uses sensors to scan the people for an individual who has gestured that they would like the drink or for whom an electronic analysis of sensor data indicates them to be in a predetermined cognitive state. End of quote. In other words, the drone can tell that you need coffee. I mean, yes, please, right? But now can we get one for beer? All right, we're going. Dow Industrial's off 88 today, 0.3%. NASDAQ, 29 points higher, 0.3%. S&P 500, basically flat. Sarah Bruguiere, Jake Gorski, Drew Josta, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.